outside as well, which is kind of you, thank you. And we have our other panelists, our outside guests, to help us bring a bookend to one of the major elements of the course, which was all of the scuffling over copyright. Well, of course, in past sessions, we've gotten a crash course in copyright, particularly focusing on contributory infringement as it related to Napster. Along the way, we learned a lot about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Given that that was several months ago, not only have you had a lot of time to learn a bunch of things in addition, but you've had plenty of time to forget everything you know about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So this will be a bit of a refresher, and we'll get to see the thing in action as we reenact in detail that would make you want to stick your neck out of the window and watch the car crash as it unfolds the DVD DECSS case. And we're incredibly fortunate to have with us two lawyers who were quite active in the case on different sides, I think it's fair to say, although one styles herself a friend of the court, really, rather than a friend of one side or another. And in addition, Charles Nesson, who submitted another entrance brief in the case. So basically, much of the people who have been involved in this scrap are here. And I hope it will help start vectoring us towards what will be our interviewing session next Tuesday, when we try to figure out what all of this means and what we've learned that first time that we all decided that Napster is probably illegal, but we really like it. I don't do myself in that way. I'm just giving a sense of the class, as I recall it, as we talked about it. So let me start just by introducing Chuck Sims. Chuck Sims is an attorney who spent 9 years as the National Staff Counsel to the American Civil Liberties Union. And then in a stunning turnaround, ended up going to private practice working for Proskauer Rose, and has had such varied casework as a case involving who owns the Tony Awards. And I guess it doesn't specifically mean the literal awards you get handed, but rather, who
has a videotapes of the annual award presentation?
9 years of videotapes of past awards presentation. That's a gold bug just waiting to be exploited. The old Tony Awards show.
You need to get so many permissions to use the various material from composers, songwriters, directors, producers, that how much remote that is very interesting.
I see. If only all of those public interests.
If you're not going to have permission to do anything, we'll be very welcome.
Yes. Also, I guess, Bell pursuing a number of copy shops, is that right?
I represented a bunch of leading publishers in a suit against Kinko's in the early 90s and confirmed the proposition that the wholesale making of course text, which consisted of chapter length or greater excerpts of a book sold by Kinko's, which made Kino a lot of money, but didn't make the authors of the books any money, was unlawful.
So it's thanks to Chuck when I walk into a Kinko's with one of my own off-prints of a law review article I've written, inexplicably seek to Xerox it to make a copy. Why I want a copy of it, I don't know. It's thanks to Chuck that the guy behind the counter says, I'm sorry, I can't copy your article because it says copyright 2000 standard law review at the bottom. So it's not really yours. So thank you for having taken care of that. And I guess just the third of the triumvirate was a suit involving the theme song to the Sally Jesse Raphael show. Is that right?
Yeah, I would call it the triumvirate. If you answered my first round case, I'd like to talk about that.
Yes, it's a question of the case.
Sally Jesse Raphael was sued by somebody claiming that their song, the theme song, infringed his Quran's
main song, and it didn't work. Excellent. At least the ACLU was probably with you on the third case. Perhaps your old colleague's not as happy about the second.
I think that copyright is the end of the free expression. I think that was the most Supreme Court case. And, I mean, I don't consider this, which I consider it, and I've been working for the interest of expression all along.
Gotcha. Even as he was muttering under his breath as we were setting up today, that the music you were listening to actually constituted a public performance.
I wondered whether there was an ASCAP.
Yes, of course there's an ASCAP. I think there's an ASCAP license. Is there an ASCAP license? Need I say more? Okay, so in addition to Chuck, we have Wendy Seltzer, who is HLS 99. Perhaps her greatest claim to fame, among many as bears on this class, is the fact that it was Wendy who coded the rotisserie.
Infamy.
Yeah, well, I noticed there was a pregnant pause. Would it be impolite to boo? Deciding that, well, she was just the vessel of making it happen, not the actual party responsible. It's sort of contributory misery infringement rather than direct misery infringement, thanks to your coding. But tell us also how you fit into this particular case.
Well, I've been running the Open Law Forum, which you can find at openlaw.org. And there we've united a group of people, mostly non-lawyers, programmers, and other interested people, discussing the GDD DCSS cases. And the discussions got pretty heated, and people decided that they wanted to submit an amicus brief in the district court. You can find all 9,000 some odd messages there.
Do we even know any work on this? She's a private practice now.
Pen?
Sorry.
The primary concern of these people was that the CSS code on DVDs and the licensing practices of the movie studios were impairing their rights to play the movies on the computers that they wanted to watch DVDs on, and barring them from making any sort of fair use of the movie. And so together, out of those, say 5,000 of those messages, we put together an amicus brief in the district court, which was unfortunately disregarded in the final ruling.
It was formally lodged, you just mean substantively. The fruits of the brief not reflected by the court. Gotcha. Professor Nesson, why don't you briefly introduce yourself and say how you fit in the case?
I'm Professor Nesson. You can call me Professor. My interest in this is that, as far as I can see, there's an inevitable and deep conflict that opened up as soon as the container for a digital for property was broken, basically. As soon as it became digital, and we no longer had a tie to physical objects like CDs and tapes and records, there was just an inevitable chasm that opened up that I don't see easily resolving itself. The question in my mind is not so much should there be some way to protect the property rights of copyright owners. Clearly there should be. But the question is, how far is it actually going to go? Where does someone draw a viable and workable midline so that the extensions that are required to provide the protections that Charter will clearly argue for don't sweep in much more than they might otherwise? And the DVD case just seems like a wonderful small example of that impending battle. In every case, you know, we can see the implications. So my interest is pretty much in following it. I'm still very much looking for the emergence of some kind of truly viable middle ground that doesn't sweep too far, as it still protects what's there. So that's my interest.
Gotcha. So I want to explore the DDCSS case in a way that has us actually feel like we totally understand the factual basis, what's the conflict going on, have a brief tour of perhaps disagreements over the doctrine, over how we think the outcome of the case should have been, and then finally actually take a step back and wholly apart from the doctrinal outcome, see how the different players fit into it, and even if we can predict, given how the cases come about, the pieces are falling into place, what do we think it's going to look like 5 years from now? As we talk about digital content getting professionally produced, distributed, enjoyed, etc. And I'd say it's fair to say that about half the sessions we've had so far have been at least bit pieces contributing to the puzzle of what it might look like 5, 6 years from now. So with that, I wonder if our panel shouldn't attempt to tell the story of the case and can be corrected as need be by those who have actually been involved in it. And in a way, it's a good way of figuring out how does this case play to the public? What's the perception by the alert people on the panel who, of course, did their readings and familiarized themselves with the case, what they gleaned about the factual situation? Who among the four of you wants to take it first? Go for it.
Okay, I think I will. Please correct me when I go wrong, which is inevitable, I'm sure. Basically, the parties to the case were the plaintiffs, which were the eight major members of the Motion Picture Association. And the defendant was 2600 Magazine, or the people who are sort of involved in 2600 Magazine, which is like a hacker magazine, apparently. And what the defendants did, as far as I understand, they did not themselves craft the code, but instead they had information regarding DCSS on their web pages, and they had links to, I guess, to where you could find how to crack the code. And under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, there's this thing called the Anti-Circumvention Clause, which basically makes it a crime, in fact, to crack encryption code and to tell others how to do it.
But there also is
a criminal aspect to it, though, is there not? If you make money off it?
I'm not sure that there is a criminal element.
Okay, so the civil element of the, I guess, the anti-circumvention clause not being a civil part of that. And they got a preliminary injunction a while back, and then the case that came down, the ruling that came down in August, basically said that the defendants had violated the DMCA, and they were enjoined from having links to places where you could find how to decrypt, or I'm sorry, yeah, decrypt, is that a word? CSS? I'm sorry, you want to go ahead and make a call.
No, I need to make a call.
Okay.
First of all, when they were first sued, they had DCSS on the website. They were hit with a preliminary injunction barring them from continuing to provide it. Okay. So at that point, they took it off the website. They issued a call to hackers around the world to mirror the site as it existed right before they took it off. And then they said, please let us know, let us 2600 know, if you've done this and send us the address so that we can put the links back on our site and continue the struggle to provide DCSS against the motion picture industry. So they got back website addresses from sites around the country and around the world, mostly around the world. They then, this was a fact that did not come out until the middle of the trial under questioning of the defended by the judge, which was one of the studies in the state courtroom. But it turns out that he got all these addresses back, website addresses back. He didn't just put them up on his site, he then went and looked at each one of them. And only once he determined that the website actually had DCSS, did he then create the link onto the 2600 page. And so the injunction that was sought at the trial and granted was not an injunction against linking, it was an injunction against providing DCSS by any means. And we said, and the judge agreed, that he had been providing it by these links, which is to say, I think it's an important qualification missed by various amateur briefs. We never argued, and the judge never found, that linking of any sort was unlawful. What we said was Congress has prescribed a provision of DCSS. And in this case, the facts show that this person was providing DCSS.
So, Wendy's getting ready to jump in, but before we get into the merits of the case, I just want to be sure we actually understand how this thing came about. So before there was DECSS, there was CSS. And how does CSS fit into things? I have in my hands, courtesy of the audiovisual department, now I know why they're on the way so quickly, they have things to do. I have a movie from 1968 dubbed by the Beatles, sort of dubbed by the Beatles. You know, the voices dubbed of the cartoon Yellow Submarine are not the Beatles' voices. It's got four actors with British accents to pretend that they were the Beatles, and then dubbed into songs. Sorry to disappoint you, but that other, it's right around Christmas time, too, isn't it? Anyway, movie's made in 68. The digital versatile disc comes along. Looks suspiciously like a compact disc, indeed it's the same size. And here's the DVD. You stick it into a DVD player, and it plays the disc in incredibly high fidelity because it's digitally recorded. It won't get bad over time, or if it does, you have error correcting mechanisms to try to salvage a nick in the disc, that kind of thing. And it's sort of in digital fashion, only the player won't over the bad parts. Alright, so we have the DVD. And there are a number of schemes before any manufacturer could be allowed to take a 1968 movie and put it into this very high-quality format. I imagine that the content producers wanted to see that there were certain limitations on what you could do with these things, right?
Yeah, the content producers, the motion picture companies, saw this technology coming. And their position was, we would love to make our movies available to the public in better quality than we can on VHS, but we simply cannot do it prudently until two things happen. We develop a secure technology so that we can do it without having all of our works ripped off around the world instantaneously, and we need additional legislation from Congress so that that kind of protection will be enforceable. And as John pointed out a number of times at trial, and I think in the opinion, there's actually a First Amendment interest then in the whole law that was passed because it was the enactment of the secure protection that induced the motion picture companies to make this kind of content available.
Okay, we're still in the state of effect section here.
Yes. But in other words, the motion picture companies had the technology to just do DVDs nakedly some years before they were willing to put them out.
Gotcha. Just as they were hesitant to have much to do with the internet, maybe still are, until there's some assurance that they put their content out.
And just as there are a lot of books that are not yet available on e-books because they're waiting for technological.
Gotcha. So the content scrambling system does what exactly? How does it work?
I know, thank you, but essentially it has some programming so that it will only. Essentially, it has a pass key system. There are keys in there. And if you put it into a DVD player, the DVD player looks for the keys that it's expecting to find. If it finds them, it unlocks the thing and plays it. And if it doesn't find the right keys, it won't play.
So, content scrambling system. It turns out to amount to approximately 400 keys. Generated on one fine day. All right, we made 400 keys, and each key can be given to a different manufacturer of a DVD player. So if you manufacture a DVD player, you're going to have to get a key from the powers that be, and we should talk about who the powers that be are in a second. And that key gets embedded in the hardware of your player. And when you get a DVD, you present your key to the DVD, and hope that it can unlock certain information without which you would not know how to play the DVD. Information about where on this shiny disc you can find the first chapter of the movie. Without knowing what the first chapter is, you can't play it in sequence. And that kind of data is in an area that you try to unlock using your keys. And one of the 400 keys will unlock it. The reason why you don't give the same key to everybody is that at some point, you want to revoke the key from a given licensor. You don't like the way a particular DVD manufacturer has been implementing their DVD player. You can at least start prospectively making new discs that don't answer to their key. And slowly then, your DVD player starts acting spottily as new discs don't work upon it because of some dispute between the DVD player manufacturer and the consortium that generated these 400 keys. What can you tell us about this consortium?
The consortium is, the technology was developed by either Toshiba or Toshiba and Time Warner, I don't remember which, so 6 months into the trial. It was developed by some technology companies. They had something that would be useful if content was available for it. The content companies were looking for something similar. So they formed an arrangement, they formed an entity that holds the rights. and the licenses are available essentially for free out of it for the administrative cost to anybody who wants to make a compliant player and will play by a few simple rules. And one of the rules is the compliant player means one which does not have the capability of copying the digital stream onto the internet or.
So there wouldn't be a digital out in the back of the player for which if you looked up a cable boom, it could just take the decrypted stuff and throw it onto a hard drive to be used later in any fashion that might be. And I guess there are other restrictions as well. For example, we have a DVD loaded into a hopper here. See if this thing works. Apparently it's the first time it's been used in this room. So here's a DVD. And notice it's a special 4-hour class today. So in the event, I guess we'll just have to play the movie because the remote doesn't work, of course. Curse you, Andy. So we hit play. Oh, notice it's a little not. Not DVD. Well, for some reason we can't play the movie. But if we were to play the movie, we could see the movie. Probably only be able to show you a small snippet. It might be, I don't know, there is this inexplicable but friendly symbol that indicates it knows what I want it to do, it just doesn't want to do it. No matter what button I push. In fact, you know what, this might be the wrong region or something. Remember we talked about regional DVD? Another of the copy protection schemes is the idea that each player in a geographic region identifies itself as such, and a region 1 disc won't play a region 2 player. So bad as the content producer, you can stage releases of your movies at different times around the world. Now, I happen to have, for research purposes, a DVD player in my office. And what's so funny about that? And I also have a VCR. So I just ran some patch cable from the output of the DVD that only runs to your TV set to the input of the VCR I hit record. And I recorded the following tape. This is going to be Peter Bray's trial advocacy workshop or the following Brandon Wheel. It's like David. He always puts a whale tie, that's true. Okay, so here's the tape I made. Can you see it? Oh, there's something. Wait a minute. Oh. So this is part of the movie. And as you'll notice, the quality is less than good. And it's not just because VCRs don't produce very good quality. It's because the hardware manufacturers of the DVD, in order to get their license for the content scrambling system, the free license, in addition, have to agree to add a chip, a so-called macrovision chip, that will put little blips and interruptions in the movie every 5 seconds or so, if it is put into a VCR. And it's literally sort of a wrench thrown into the gears of a VCR. The VCR doesn't have to be built to be compliant with this scheme in our earlier parlance. It doesn't have to be a trusted VCR. Because the way most consumer VCRs work is they grab a sync signal from what they expect to be a constant pulse coming over the wire, and this wrench makes sure that that constant pulse does not come out. It's the sort of thing that does not confuse the TV set, but will confuse the VCR, so we end up with this. So, okay, this is all part of the content protection scheme. Let me just make sure that Peter Murray is not up here. There we go. That is built into DVDs. Okay, so the consortium, who's in the consortium?
The consortium is Toshiba and whatever other, there are three groups of companies, consumer electronics companies, consumer electronics companies, computer companies, and entertainment companies, together with the people who own the.
Gotcha. And so they do these licenses, and if you violate the license, you can stand to have your key revoked. There might be other contractual remedies.
Well, all the remedies would be contractual, I guess, but yeah.
Yes, but in addition, there's the new law now, 1998 EMCA, that is meant to be a way of, in addition to however hard it may be to get the secret sauce, and if a key were compromised, to simply advertise that key or find out a way without being a licensor and thereby subject to contractual provisions of the license, to be able to play a movie, you still could get in trouble. And that's the DMCA as far as you're concerned?
Yes. It's essentially comparable to the laws against the sale of burglars. We have laws against burglars tools. Not because we don't, I mean, we already have laws making burglary unlawful, but legislature figured out that an additional law provided an added layer of protection. And when the technology of copying, digital copying became what it is, and so the cost per copy went down to the staggering extent that it has, Congress stepped in and provided what is essentially a law against a law criminalizing the distribution of burglary tools for digital copying.
And how did DECSS appear? Who wrote it?
A 17-year, so it was written apparently by a 17-year-old Norwegian kid together with a man in Germany who the Norwegian kid never met. He's got some weird handle, which I can't remember right now. But they had a little group, it's going to be called Cell, of people who were trying to defeat this kind of protection because it was there.
Because it was there.
Because it was there.
Because it turns out, I guess, that if you, in fact, at least today, defeat the protection, get around the content scrambling system, and get the unadulterated digital fire hydrant of data that's on being John Malkovich, it actually results in a huge hard drive worth of stuff. It's fairly unwieldy, right? You can't exactly zap it all around the net.
Well, you can divot it, which is compress it. Almost all movies, especially if they're not longer than 2.5 hours, can be compressed onto one CD with really no loss of fidelity, except for real video file, maybe on what I would do.
Gotcha. So this program seems clearly to fall under the textual provisions of 1201, 17 U.S.C. 1201A, that say if you make something that circumvents something that effectively protects works covered by Title 17, you're in trouble. Trouble may be felony, trouble may be you are subject to a private cause of action.
Right. And I think it's worth pointing out that when Congress passed the statute, they didn't know whether the circumvention device it's going to be hardware or software, and the law covers both. I mean, Congress, some legislative history talks about black boxes. Clearly, you could do the same thing in a piece of hardware or with a string of code, and that's, I think, one of the interesting things about the case, and it's of some relevance, I think, later on when we get to the First Amendment issue.
Gotcha. So, Libby, what's wrong with this? Why is this not a straightforward application of the law about burglary tools?
Well, there are two problems with the law about burglary tools, or calling this a law about burglary tools. There's no First Amendment interest in going into somebody's house with burglar's tools just to take a look around. There is a First Amendment interest in taking a look at copyrighted material and copying snippets, and that's what we know is fair use, to take a quotation from a movie to use in this excerpt in class as a demonstration, to criticize, to report on as news. And the second First Amendment problem is the speech in the code itself. When this statute is applied to software written in a human readable language or language readable with difficulty by humans, is speech, it's discussion of how technology works. And if this, Section 1201, the anti-circumvention provision, is read to prohibit software, it prohibits discussion of the kind that the technologists on my open law forum want to have about how the guts of a DVD player work, and what's this thing sitting in my machine doing, and how can I make it work with a different operating system.
Gotcha. So Chuck, let's work backwards here. Thinking back to your ACLU days, from which you see no conflict with your current position, if somebody were to publish a tract that said, here's how to get around those stupid punch locks that they put on the bathroom doors so that you can't go to the bathroom if you want to. And it turns out that exactly. I mean, that's the way it's humiliating experience.
But I think it's sort of speech, actually.
But if somebody published a tract that said, here's a way to get around those. It turns out that if you punch 554 and then hold down the 1, there's a bug in the lock, and it pops open no matter what the code is supposed to be. Is that a burglary tool?
Look, there is no problem with discussion either about the quality of the law or about what, you know, the discussion you've been having. What is CSS? All of that is perfectly fine.
Well, I didn't know I had a broken law
here. Well, I'll tell you what. If the door of the Metropolitan Museum happened to have a voice-activated numerical code to open it, and if the code happened to be 12345, and I uttered 12345, I found out that that was it, and I told lots of people about it, that would be actionable. Not that it is.
That's how people about it would be actionable.
Giving it to people. There are definitely laws about the provision under various circumstances of the codes to various safes, combinations of safes.
And the ACLU hairs on your neck don't raise over restrictions of this sort of thing.
They don't raise because they are clearly aimed not at speech, but aimed at conduct. And they passed the test that the court has used 25 times to uphold congressional actions designed to be permissible evidence of regulations of conduct and speech.
Now, I guess some of the people that are upset the way things have gone, here's an example of a t-shirt you can buy online for $15. On the front of the t-shirt, there's a not sign through DBB/CCA, CCA being the nonprofit alliance that stewards the 400 keys to CSS. And here's the back of the shirt. The back of the shirt is the operative code DCSS.
Look, there are lots of clever people in the world, and every principle can be tested, and nobody is sued about this.
You have been sued about this. There's a recent article about that.
My clients have sued about this. I'm not sure that that is a... the fact that clever people can decide to test the law, one of the more interesting things I've heard actually along these lines is Stephen King, is that the author from Maine, the guy?
He is the author from Maine.
He was describing the first book that he put on the
net. Riding in the Bullets.
Not the second one where he did it on the other.
The plan.
The first one was available, I guess, for a reader, where he put it out. I forget what the amount of money was. It was something like $2.50, $3. And he said when they first put it out, one of the things his publisher thought was so extraordinary is that they looked and there were people, think like the computer techies could tell, around the country who were spending 20, 30, 40 hours trying to hack through the protection. Right? The thing cost $2 or $3.
It was ultimately free. It was ultimately free.
There was no rational reason for anybody to do it. But the fact that it was protected meant that some people couldn't stand it.
So what conclusion does this draw you?
The conclusion draws me is that if you try to protect any piece of property, and living in New York City is already probably this some years ago, there will be some people who will try to grab your property. But we don't give up on attempting protection because some people will do the wrong thing.
Wendy, you want to get in on that? This is where, as long as we're in the doctrinal blood fight, does anyone want to add on?
The problem that we have is not with protecting the property. It's going beyond what copyright has traditionally allowed publishers and authors to do with protecting their property. When you publish a book, you don't have control over what order people turn the pages in, whether people choose to present the paragraph from the end before they read the beginning.
But that's because you choose to publish a book in a promiscuous way, if you just do it the normal codex way. Putting it into a binding and wrapping it around and then selling it at a bookstore. I mean, in a way, you might argue that that's the risk that music companies take when they release CDs. And CDs, though they look like DVDs, don't have CSS protecting them. And that's why it's relatively easy these days just to rip the tracks. And you'll notice there's no DMCA action against Napster. It's just contributory copyright infringement, which is a dicey proposition thing.
But I think it's no accident that copyright evolved at a time when publishing was done in books. It was part of publishing work, and until 1976, gaining each rights to read it in private and to excerpt portions if they chose to, in return for the federal protection against wholesale copying and redistribution.
Got it.
And when CSS denies us that, it does a lot more to upset the balance of copyright than to take away the reader's rights material.
I think what that argument misses, and I have a few more examples, is that fair use has always lived within the limitations of access to work that you have to get. There are wonderful paintings that have been in the Metropolitan Museum, and then they get sold to Sotheby's, and they may be totally lost to view. Now, I have a theoretical right of fair use, but if the painting happens to be in somebody's living room in Geneva, my right of fair use, even though it exists totally unfettered, is as a practical matter less powerful than it is if the painting is up there. If it's in a museum that says no photography, fair use means something a little different as a practical matter than if it's in the various museums that allow photography.
And the parties can choose to allow some people in but not others.
Absolutely.
Or allow them in on the condition that they take no pictures and not talk about what they saw later.
They're limited. Well, not talk about it is another matter, although probably they could do that. I think nobody would. The theater is another great example. I mean, plays are produced on Broadway, and I'm sure here in Boston all the time. But you can't.
Yeah, he gets some plays out of here.
Sure. in most theaters, your right of fair use doesn't mean that you can take a snippet of that performance.
You can't force the actors with a cattle prod to do the
thing. You can't turn on a sound recorder, much less a video recorder. And that doesn't mean that there isn't fair use. Professor Nesson found a brief, and one of the great examples I use this in all my talks about this case, is you said my fair use rights are infringed or abridged or hampered because I like to teach using snippets from the verdict in my class. And the fact is, when I was a kid, and I'm sure when you were a kid, there were lots of movies, there were better movies then than there are now, there was fair use. But you couldn't make a perfect digital snippet, and it didn't mean that your fair use rights, much less your First Amendment rights, were being infringed. It simply meant that fair use meant you remembered what was in the movie. Or you waited until, Cinderella came back 4 years from then. And so fair use, most of what is fair use doesn't require perfect digital snippets. In fact, virtually none requires perfect digital snippets. And there are lots of ways you can still use current in the class. It may not be quite as convenient and quite as simple as being able to, grab a 2 minute digital piece. But on the other hand, Congress thought that there were interest powerful things on the other hand, namely the creation inducing function of copyright, and passed a statute weighing those in a particular way.
So that's now about it. I mean, you can just get the verdict on VHS, right? And play it if your heart's content. You just got to fuss with it, then it has an hour.
Or bring it to play it yourself.
Well, I, in a way, completely agree with you in the sense that this is obviously a situation in which there's advancing technology. Your industry faces the problem that unless you have some anti-circumvention legislation, you're dead. You're in the business of selling water in the desert when it starts to rain. You need some way to contain your product. And when you lose the physical container, you have to build an encryption container. I agree with that. What's more, I can see that you have a huge problem because you have to deal with a hardware industry that wants to sell hardware. So you can't build a very good encryption container. You have to build a crummy one. It takes enough code that you fit on the back of a shirt to break through. So that's your problem. Your problem is you need the law in order to preserve the viability of your industry. And you need the law in a big way. You need the law to prevent people from doing relatively simple things to break in to the encryption packages that you put out. I agree with that. All right, but now you come along and you make the law which says we are going to allow content owners to package their content in flimsy encryption packages and protected by law so that nobody can get into it. Well,
nobody can copy the digital signal. anybody with a $299 Oscar Food Pack, DVD player can get it. There's no limitation, can you?
If it's a DVD player, the right region.
Okay.
So what's the restriction, what's the limitation on liberties that is so elected?
Well, the biggest restriction that I see that comes out of this is that you, first of all, have to make it illegal for anyone to break in. That is, for anybody to be in a position to make a decision to cut the
machine to cut.
Right.
And so they can't have exceptions to the
And then you have to make it, well, here's my question. You can put the question. It seems that the direction, you make a very kind of fine point about the scope of capitalist order in DVD as not being directed to linking, but rather being directed to providing. But it's such a fine link that it seems to evaporate, at least when I look at it. It seems that your industry is inevitably going to be pushing for two things. One is, you're going to want to stop anybody from putting up on the net the code that breaks encryption package or links to it. That is, you're going to want to make it as difficult as you can possibly make it to get to what you call verbally students. And then secondly, you're going to worry if it's possible for any of us to communicate with each other digitally without somebody being able to monitor it. That is, as long as it's possible for all of us peer to peer to exchange digital stuff without you knowing what it is we're exchanging, your industry is threatened. Would you agree with that?
Well, if what you're saying is people are scared to shift this around the column, yes, they're scared around the column, but present law doesn't provide for any sort of monitoring, and nobody is looking for any sort of monitoring. I mean, look, I've got some frivolous communications that I can't believe, but what I can say is that the notion that the motion picture companies were eager to seek the relief they sought against Portland, or that the decision with respect to linking was an easy one. And I think if you look at the briefs, you see, nobody thinks that when the New York Times, none of my clients think, that when the New York Times reports on this case and happens to include a reference to 2600 or even a link, but that is actionable. Not a sentence in any group says that, and nobody thinks that.
And so far, teaching about it seems to be okay. Yeah, there's some nice
teaching about it is fine. It's the provision of the tool. I mean, Judge Campbell's decision, we had cited a bunch of cases that stand for the proposition that once you've been enjoined, you have to stay a safe distance. He didn't cite those. He relied on another doctrine, which was, and he mentioned the New York Times, but he said, look, you know, what they do, any belief against linking has to be focused on an intent to provide. And the whole record showed that Coral here, 2600, wanted to provide. That was his purpose. And the New York Times doesn't want to provide it. It wants to report the news. Now, is it a fine distinction? There's a line there. There are lots of areas of law where the notion which permeates much of the open law discussion, for example, I looked at a few months ago, that the motion picture companies are trying to control everybody's use of everything is, strikes me as delusional, actually. The motion picture companies
added
that
way. Illusory is a combination of delusional and illusory.
They're animated, I said that for the first time.
Illusional.
They're being attended not by a desire for more control, but by fear of total loss.
Yeah, but that's today. I agree with you. Right now, they're scared.
They have less control over their movies than they used to.
But they've engaged in a litigation strategy. The copyright industry, so to speak, has engaged so far been almost totally successful. God forbid, but they've proceeded against Master, Scour, DVD, they've done great. And each time they do great, they face a problem one level further up the road. And it seems to me inevitable that their mitigation strategy is going to get more ambitious as they continue to succeed. The copyright industry has never indicated a willingness to take less than it could. I mean, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act itself is evidence. The copyright industry wants what it can get. It wants all the wealth that the technology of the current era can deliver to it.
And if the hackers ever seen something they didn't want to hack?
No.
I mean, here's the free Stephen King book. Let's hack it.
Yeah. That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
The last few things you said sort of indicated, again, that the motion picture companies are looking for to increase the amount of control. And in fact, I think the leakage of their product is much greater than it ever has been. And the technology means that the risks will continue to contribute. Because nobody's going to invest in making a $40 million or such $200 million movie unless they think they can recoup their investment. That is just the case. And that takes us back to what the Supreme Court keeps saying is the function of copyright law, which is to protect the inducements to creation. Now, there are better things to create than the new Schwarzenegger $200 million movie, but yeah, everything's permitted. And if people like those movies, there's got to be protection for the
investment. I think somebody has to kill a lion in order to go on.
I'm curious about the Stephen King novel, because my impression of it was actually, my just a reaction to it was quite different than yours, because I was amazed that so many people paid the $2 for it, even though it was also available free.
That's the second one. There were two different books that he's made available. The second one was available for free and it was on the honor system. The first one did have some sort of rudimentary protection, and you pay a small amount of money and the protection evaporated.
My curiosity about it, I guess, actually isn't even disturbed by my lack of actual accuracy, but it's just that it seems that regardless of all of the hacking that would be done one way or the other, most people are just going to obey the very flimsy encryption that exists.
Well, Napster would make you very, very concerned if you had your money at stake as to whether or not people would start just taking movies off the websites if they were available on websites, which they're available to be acquired now. There are sites that were entered into evidence where you can just connect with various people that make your own arrangements and get download them. Although you can't have Scour and Kilowatt technology. Scour had various movies unlawfully available for demo.
So here we have that sort of acted out, this has been acted out so many times, the argument over who is likely to win an arms race between somebody who wants to get to something and somebody who wants to create scarcity for that something, for reasons that may have to do with recouping investments so to make something to begin with. And just making an empirical prediction as to who's going to win and what might be needed to influence the outcome of that arms race. My own sense is that there's some agreement that you can't make something perfectly airtight, but in that middle zone, you can raise the costs of cracking it to be high enough that the 85% of us who are schmoes, who just sort of go where we're told and click where it's obvious to click rather than going into Google and looking into these hacking sites. That's the body we need to have on one side of the line versus the other as far as the content people are concerned, right? It's called keeping the honest people honest.
It's like speeding enforcement and drug enforcement. Nobody thinks that they need perfect enforcement, but a serious effort will get you a lot of success.
Although with drug enforcement, it's not clear the level of success that it's been.
As parents of teenagers, I think there's some success.
Gotcha. John, you wanted to get in, if anybody else wants to get in, that's fine too, go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a quick question. You said earlier that the reason that the movie industry, as far as you can tell, is scared right now is because of the potential to create perfect digital copy. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah. Nobody needed the DMCA until...
Yeah. If that's the case, why would CSS scramble a digital recording to an analog medium as we just put it into the VCR? It's impossible to make a perfect digital copy of the DVD on what we ingest it. There's inherent degradation there, and there will be even more degradation as that tape is copied on other VHS tapes.
The whole macro vision part of the story is the one that I do not have great grasp of, so I can tell you.
I was interested to see, if you go into Google, I was saying, taking this macro vision thing as an example, suppose you were in that 85%, and you wanted to find out, you know, it's frustrating, you have a DVD player, you have a VCR, you want to make some copies, so you just type in DVD, VCR, record, and see what pops up. And the first thing is a product called the Go Video DVR 5000. You look at Google's summary, and it says you can record from DVD to VCR, which is unusual in consumer devices. Go Video bypasses the macro vision that is used, .. So you click, you say, wow, here's like a renegade, you know, what is it, like a South Korean manufacturer that doesn't have any deals with anybody. And then you read it, and it turns out that Google lied. You can record from DVD to VCR, which is unusual. No, only in non-macro vision DVDs. Interesting. So then I just jump back, and here's the region patches forum. So here are how to do the region hacks. If you have a DxR3 creative card and then you get the right Hollywood Plus drivers and program. And you notice there are a bunch of these combo units, but they don't work to do copying from DVD to VHS. Now, I mean, why would you guess that it wasn't when you copy a DVD to a VHS? It doesn't just give you a fairly reliable but still degraded analog copy, that gives you a dysfunctional copy, one that just you can't watch.
The same reason that the hackers hack the Stephen King ebook, because they can.
You go as far as you can.
And the movie studios will restrict as far as they can.
So isn't, then aren't the macro vision people entitled to go as far as they can go?
Sure. But what's unclear to me is why you should have a legal remedy for, as you would describe it, the arms race, someone who buys a DVD player and a VCR, why you should have a legal remedy against them if they decide to go as far as they can go against the macro vision.
Comment?
I'm sorry, I know we've had this a number of times, but why isn't this just like the argument of you cannot break my house as long as the lock's strong enough, so I should be required to make a strong lock as I can, otherwise there's no legal remedy. I mean, there's sort of fair use provisions for a house, and then you have necessity provisions where I can go in and break in and get some food if I need it.
This kind of
those fair uses by having a large lock. I've got a lesser lock where you can do that in emergency, but if I can't get a legal protection, I sort of won't.
This pretty well rebuts Nesson's point that says, you know, the producers are looking to wrap their stuff in the flimsiest encryption and then have the government dogs charge after anybody plows through it. And certainly that's what we would require. If I happen to leave, I choose to leave my front door unlocked and my screen door open, I certainly should be able to have recourse if somebody charges into my house and knocks over some stuff else.
I think there's obviously a big difference between real property and intellectual property. Each time someone, you know, decrypts DVD does not inherently injure you in the same way that someone even walking around your house would injure you. So it seems to me that that's a huge difference. And I mean, I don't understand why the industry isn't just trying to be, I mean, if this is what's going to happen, if anything is going to be crap, why not just be more creative and try to find sources of revenue than, and I guess, kind of suppressing people for doing something they're going to do anyway?
Why not turn your house into a public museum?
No, why not? I don't know. Be creative if you're not interested in revenue.
Well, there's a great answer to that. Jane Ginsburg, who's a copyright in Columbia, pointed out that in a world in which copying was really simple, someday academic journals will sell one copy for $1 million instead of a billion copies for $5.
Academic journals will still get their stuff.
That's not a good covenant. The fact is, the protection of my house doesn't depend on how expensive a lock I get. And that pricing flexibility in getting revenues is something they work on all the time. That's what the whole reach and coding thing is all about. They can charge far fewer, far less money to watch a movie in Bangladesh than they do in California. They still get some revenues, but because of the region coding and the protection of the forts, they can charge more in wealthy Western countries and less in third world countries. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. Most of our community.
This may bring to mind an earlier session we had on striking a similar subject. So,
no, that's from an empirical point of view, the main, I guess, the most plausible reason, which is normally used in defending mechanisms like NEXT or BCSS, is that they, in a way, allow people to still, you know, carry their life for fair use. But, I mean, from an empirical point of view, the point I found interesting was when NEXT had struck a deal with one of the companies, that they would charge a fee for people, you know, downloading files from Napster. One angry hacker, not hacker, sorry, one angry user of Napster sent an email to the Napster site saying that I don't care about living in a community with other people and sharing people for sharing files for a fee. I want files for free without paying. So I guess the whole controversy about either Napster or the CSS is not about fair use. It's a little bit too naive. I think that both techniques are basically not about freedom, but they're about price, if I may paraphrase.
So you're saying it's not about high-minded fair use principle, but it's basically, just as this class was an example, people who want free stuff that they don't want to have to pay for,
yeah,
and people who want to have to charge for stuff they need.
First of all, I agree with Mr. Sims. I have problems in understanding how could the technique in itself, you know, limit after everything we've done and read and said about it, we still have conceptual problems understanding how could it essentially limit fair use. What it does, if you want to use a DVD in our class, all you have to do is to buy a DVD player and to buy the DVD CD and show it to us. I don't see why the technique itself disallows it to do that.
So Wendy, let me just put it to you then, as he was saying. Suppose you had the motion picture people offer a form of fig leaf, a peace offering of some sort. I guess a fig leaf is something you barely cover something with. So it's not a fig leaf, it's an olive branch. They offer an olive branch to the hacker community, and they say, you know what, come on over, we'll buy the drinks, we'll pay airline tickets, let's have a week-long conference, and let's talk, and we'll see about maybe changing the way macro vision works, so that you can get a cruddy but not dysfunctional copy of DVD on your VCR. And we'll change the way that DVDs work, so that you can get any segment up to 20 seconds just fine, but more than 20 seconds is a problem. In other words, they want to make a good faith effort to enable the fair use, but still keep out what he thinks are really the moving forces here, people who want the whole enchilada and they want it free. How does that sound to you?
It sounds tempting, but I'm not going to bite the olive quite yet. It answers some of the problems. It certainly deals with the more usual fair uses.
So what are the other problems? I mean, suppose I'm here. Suppose I'm from Warner Brothers. And I say... So you think we're all against you. I have my Warner Brothers code.
That it's prohibiting things that are not copyright infringements.
What are these other
matters? 39.5 is a prohibiting things that are not covered.
It's prohibiting the discussion of copy protection systems in code.
So this says basically, there is no compromise. You're not going to be happy until t-shirts and links to DECSS go up, and basically any scheme that can be hacked, can be hacked.
Essentially, yes. That the computer programs there are speech, their expression, their discussion of the workings of technology, and that's a discussion that we should be allowed to conduct. Against the discussion that there were no university classes prohibited, I would say North Carolina professor who was told by the MPAA to remove DECSS code that he was using as an example of decryption schemes in a computer class.
Gotcha. Yep.
Yeah, I'd like to just talk a little more about the First Amendment aspects of this. It seems, I've been watching sort of rhythm of use, the Napster case, and then this case. Either the people doing the hacking didn't talk to lawyers beforehand, or the industries have chosen the excellent people to sue, because from the attitude, they really are putting up two middle fingers toward the entertainment industry and saying, we're going to do what we want and screw you and screw the law and whatever, because this is our right. Horrible targets that they just look real bad. I'm thinking, though, about people, and these are the precedents that are being set, but what if, let's get back to the law technology, what if rather than saying, all right, but as these people are in essence saying, rather than, hey, you want to steal somebody's property, you know, you want to break in, here's how to do it, this will be awesome. What if they said, you shouldn't buy this lot because it's, you know, as a homeowner, I'm very concerned, and other homeowners also should be concerned, that the Webster lock can be broken into with a paper clip by bending it at this angle, and other people who are also concerned should discuss this. Now we're into the area where it's not so much the screw you record industry example, but now more, it sounds a lot like just public debate about products and about security systems and about things like that, which sounds a lot like the kind of thing that the First Amendment does protect.
For which Chuck says we're not going to go after that anyway. We don't want the New York Times to be aware.
The law doesn't define discussion as a sort of prejudice.
Well, so what it sounds like is that you're going to keep going until the hackers get smart enough not to couch their discussion of their websites in such an antagonistic way and start couching it in terms of a public debate. But now we're talking about form rather than substance, aren't we?
Well, no. There's a huge amount of public debate about the DMCA, and some people think of them once, some people think of them once. There are review articles, and not one of them that I've read had to put in the string of code that happens to be DECSS in order to comment on it in any possible way. In my view, the people who put it on the t-shirt are simply sticking their middle finger up. And, you know, whether they go after them or not, I don't think anybody's required to go after everybody who violates their rights in order to get relief against other people. But the fact is that the widespread provision of DECSS is actionable, and although there haven't been a lot of lawsuits, there have been a couple. And after we got the preliminary injunction, about 80 internet service providers took down a number of sites that were basically doing nothing but providing DECSS. So I think the motion picture companies have gotten some bang for their buck. Have they totally cleanse the marketplace? You can probably tell me in 2 minutes that they have, but
you could probably sue me in five.
No.
But try to follow the linking thing further. Okay, you have fine, you've got the number of sites taken down, but there are still sites out there, and it's still possible to link to, and it's still possible to go to Google and find, you know, in a minute,
right,
how to do it. What's the next litigation step is followed by this?
The next litigation step of Amazon, the Second Circuit, decides this case, but there is no economic rationality from a strategy which would go after everybody around the world
who's doing this.
From a cost effectiveness point of view, the NPA, for example, had an anti-piracy program for years dealing with pirate factories in Southeast Asia and various places. It's a limited budget, it's not a whole budget of the motion picture. So the logic is not economic in a world of limited resources for possibly the things that concern you, I think, are economically irrational. Nobody could afford to do them or would choose to do them. But they certainly are not going to just stand by while they get after them.
And they wouldn't think of going back to Congress and getting stronger legislation that makes it clear that linking to a site that provides is illegal.
Just speaking for myself, it's not even clear to me that such a course would have serious constitutional problems. But as I said, the argument hasn't been, and I can tell you will not be, that linking is unlawful. This person was enjoined for providing, and when he kept providing buildings, the injunction was clarified. Make plain that was covered, but that's very different. I really think it's important. It was certainly the first one as we expected it. But the arguments that they're all available on 2600 crypto, none of them say linking is unlawful.
We're at the 20-minute mark left. I want to make one point about this and then call on Sarah and then get to our panel case study, this way of rounding this out. This is just interesting. Again, we had highlighted when we talked about the DMCA weeks ago this ambiguity about what it means to say that effectively protects. I mean, the thinking of it is if you wrap the package so lazily and so poorly that even an infant can walk over and peel off the cover, you're not going to get the DMCA there to help you. You actually have to go to some effort to put some teeth into the bear trap. This is right, but I don't know. It was actually new to the case. But the secret sauce by which CSS operates is actually quite easily derived. It turns out that there are only a limited number of keys, and there's always, in pretty much any encryption system, a limited number of keys. But here, the number is so limited that it turns out that it wouldn't take great computers working till the sun extinguished itself to figure out ones that work. It's like having credit cards that only had 5 digits. And it just turned off to room 314. That's what I'm saying. That's an encryption system of a sort that isn't nearly as protective as the 16-digit code. And here, apparently, it turns out that there just aren't a whole lot of keys. So that those 400 big ones are in a population of 2 to 40th power possibilities, which for a computer just isn't all that much, bringing the question whether it effectively protects. But that's, again, just a statutory interpretation question, rather than when you spare use
And people who work on the statute, I know from our side, thought effectively protects, I think Congress thought, means essentially what it means for households. That is, a decent key, a decent lock and key effectively protects. It doesn't have to be a medical key, it certainly doesn't have to be titanium. It effectively protects if, generally speaking, you can't just go there and push it open.
Gotcha. Sarah, quick point. It's okay. Okay? Over to our panel then. Let's hear about your case study. Who wants to get us started? John, Mayor of Circuit City.
Our case study basically examines a situation that's transpiring right now with the FCC and some hearings that they have held and are going to be holding regarding digital television and the future of digital television. It relates to PCSS because one of the issues that is on the table right now is the issue of content controls and copy protection within digital TV sets, digital VCRs, DVD burners that are going to be manufactured over the next couple of years, and how the FCC is going to deal with these issues. Recently, the FCC entertained a number of motions by people in the street, content providers, retailers in certain city, and device manufacturers regarding common connection and whether or not the FCC should allow content providers and broadcasters to mandate common connection within cable set-top boxes as high-definition televisions hold that. And essentially, the FCC came to a determination on September 18th that this issue is on the table and it's not prohibited by their mandate. And they are going to make a determination by, I believe the comment period is closed December 18th or December 15th upcoming, about whether or not these set-top boxes that will be sold over the next couple of years to view digital television will have copy controls such as DCSS or a variant thereof.
So, no possible paper copy in case you're still casting about. You can submit comments to the FCC on this rule. You're one of the most knowledgeable people concerning the city I've ever met. Usually they can't tell me how to make my DVD player copy of my VHS. But, so what you're saying is basically the way you get cable is cable comes into your house. Before it goes into your TV set, especially if it's fancy dancing cable, it goes into a set-top box. And with new HD TV, high-definition TV, DVD-quality TV, it's especially going to go through a set-top box. And typically, the set-top box just comes from a laconic cable guy when he comes to wire your house, which has made the CD people quite upset because they want a piece of the pie. They want you to have to go to Circuit City and buy something so the Circuit City can get its tape if you want cable, instead of having a cable company have a monopoly on traditional boxes, right?
Yeah, and under the Telecommunications Act of 1996, the market for cable boxes was deregulated to allow people like Sony, Toshiba, Joe's, Hacker Shop in his garage to create set-top boxes and pull the monopoly away from the laconic cable
company. Then, not only to make functionally equivalent boxes that have different prices, and presumably consumer surplus would happen, and box prices would go down, just like you can now buy a telephone rather than having to rent one from AT&T, which used to be the case. I know that those have some heft to them, but they weren't exactly featureful. But then you can start competing on features as well. And maybe then one feature a consumer could demand would be a digital out. And if you have digital out, that's bad for the producers of stuff, right? But now, wouldn't this just be covered by the DMCA?
No, not necessarily, because the FCC right now is essentially deciding the issue of whether or not the content producers will be able to institute a license similar to that which the MPAA has required of device manufacturers.
Ah!
If the device manufacturer were able to create a device that did not include this content protection system, then there's no circumvention.
Gotcha. So talk to the FCC administrator. What is your interest here?
The interest in the FCC is to forward price and balance the consumer interest and the commercial interest and to try to find a problem with that. Right now, because of the lack of acceptance and distribution of high-definition television, we felt we had to step in and attempt to accelerate that.
So I appreciate your vindicating the consumer interest in slightly cheaper cable boxes. Just as your comrades at the FTC have been working hard to assure that we won't get taken by overly high ATM fees. But how about this feature aspect of things, not just price? Is it in the public interest, given that the government can stick its nose in because somehow the airwaves connect to it, the airwaves are a public trust, is it in the public interest to see to it that there isn't a copy protection scheme for cable that is as thorough as the one that appears to have evolved for DVDs with DCSS?
You might be a little bit confused about the question. But you know, losing the distinction between cable, you're saying copy cable's okay, copy HTTP is not. Why not? Is that your question?
Well, what you're telling me, John, from Circuit City, and Circuit City Man seems to explain that The government has some extra role here to play in this whole cable box controversy because of the way cable and broadcast get regulated. And as a result, the government can assert the public interest in a way that it can't or doesn't when we're talking about the Motion Picture Association and DVDs. Right?
Yeah, because of the broadcast spectrum.
And
the broadcast spectrum, the government has to regulate it.
And just what are our range of choices here? What are two possible futures that are apart from each other we can have here?
Well, at one extreme, you permit content companies to require device manufacturers copy control scheme that essentially gives content producers unlimited control. In other words, it conceivably could allow content producers to completely completely prevent home viewers from taking any television show whatsoever on HDTV. At the other end,
so you couldn't even put a show onto a VCR like I can now.
Precisely.
That's fascinating, because the Sony case said not only can VCRs exist, but VCRs do exist because Sony was able to thumb its nose at the content people and say, I don't need a license from you to make a VCR, and I can just steal it right off the airwaves, and boom, there it goes. But now you're suggesting that cable can put the kind of protection that's on DVDs, the so-called macro digital protection, so that if you try to tape off your cable, you get jumped. It sounds like Clash of the Titans, right? Because the people who make VCRs would be very happy about that.
Yeah, it certainly does. The FCC basically responded to this argument. The argument was made by the content producers in the previous comment period, and the argument essentially said, as pay-per-view movies and home movie channels proliferate, essentially, this is unlike the Sony Betamax case because the background to Sony Betamax was that imperfect copies were made for time shifting purposes and things along those lines. However, taping Braveheart onto a digital VCR or DVD burner off of HBO is no different than ripping a DVD of Braveheart and copying it onto another DVD.
Sound right, Council of Time Warner?
Yeah, as Time Warner comes, I would just say that we're in the era of promiscuous publication and.
Brilliant, don't forget to say that.
You put no Jay-Z. And that if, you know, if Congress is basically like in the DMCA, it's already balanced the sort of free speech concerns, and it came out saying that, well, fair use doesn't apply here, and so you think the Betamax case doesn't apply.
I said fair use doesn't apply here, but allow me to read you section 1201C1 of the DMCA, which provides that nothing in this section shall enlarge or diminish vicarious or contributory liability, and also says nothing in this section shall affect rights, remedies, limitations, or defenses to copyright infringement, including fair use under this title.
Perhaps I misspoke then. But it seems that as if.
The U.S. Council ready to help you.
I think if the FCC is regulating in this area, then they're regulating pursuant to 1201. They're regulating pursuant to some other.
But you say that Congress in the DMCA did a little balance and said fair use, you lose.
It said in this statute, nothing in this statute affects fair use. It doesn't say that Congress may not pass some other statute authorizing the FCC to do something.
Right, but by the logic by which Congress figures fair use should lose and the DMCA should plow forward irrespective of Wendy's fair use arguments. Similarly, you would say if you want to see Braveheart in full cinematic grandeur coming over at you through cable, we've got to have a protection scheme like that which we have in the past 2 years become accustomed for DVDs.
Look, if you assume that Congress acted within its rights in passing the DMCA. And then here's this new technology, and instead of just having Braveheart available on DVD, we're going to broadcast it digitally, or cablecast it digitally. If you could get the same perfect copy over the air through the cable, and do exactly what Congress was concerned about under 1201, then there would have been no point to go through the exercise of 1201.
That's what I came here to be saying.
And so when Congress, what the FCC, I guess, has said, if I understand this properly, I'm not believing that it's permissive, is at least for the time being, we're going to let them go ahead and try to protect their interests in a way that would protect their copyrights.
Gotcha. Cable subscriber, how is all these arguments and technical stuff zipping back and forth? What's your opinion here?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, if I'm going to be spending $9,000 to buy myself an HDTV and get access to, you know, digital picture, digital surround sound, and I want to record an episode of Seinfeld or Braveheart or whatever in the same way that I would have on my old system, I should be allowed to do so. I don't think that I should somehow have fewer rights just because the technology itself has changed to watch the program when I want to.
Well, somebody might say, we're not talking about civil rights, we're talking about a commercial transaction. Don't pay the $9,000. If you don't pay the $9,000, Circuit City suddenly becomes your advocate because they have nothing to sell you anymore. Because they don't soak you on stuff because the stuff doesn't work the way you want it to. And then they come back to Time Warner and say, this is ridiculous. You've got to work with us here to let you make one copy for home use. It's just you can't start churning them out and selling them on the street corner, right?
As a cable subscriber and a TV lover, I think that would be fine. I wouldn't mind having some sort of restriction on the number of copies that can be made. I mean, I'm not planning on doing any bootleg copies, but I want to have my rights looked out for, and I think...
Your right to make one copy.
Well, my rights, I mean, to have the same use of my TV, you know, and my recording system as I have in the past, and it's true, I wouldn't go out and buy a HDTV system to get the added quality, and I'm going to lose, you know, these other important qualities that I like, and I'm not some legal person, you know, I'm just, you know, the average Joe, and I'm saying that this is the way you're going to get my money, is by providing the same sort of services that I have now, and then more so if you want to spend the extra.
And I take it, if you're willing to pay $9,000 for the whole setup, shortly you'll pay $250 for each view of Braveheart in Cinematic Mansion.
Why would I pay? I mean, I'm already paying the cable fees to be able to watch it.
Right, that's what I mean.
Be able to watch it at a later time.
You mean that's why you want to make one copy so you can view it as often as you want, without having to pay each time.
So you're saying I can make recording, and what would happen if the recording only allowed me to watch it once?
I'm just trying to figure out what's for sale here. You're going to put a lot of money into your home entertainment lifestyle. Surely some of that money could go into content, not just cogs and gears for nifty things with blinking lights and funny room. Now maybe it's reflected in a monthly cable fee that embeds in it the likelihood that you're going to watch it lots of times, thanks to your digital VCR that lets you do it, so you'll pay $5 a month for the Braveheart channel, or the Michael Caine channel or something. Or it'll be pay-per-view with no copies, and you can pay a lower fee and not have the ability to copy it. Would you mind if there was a tiered scheme there that you could just take your pick? If you want to pay $1 but you can't make a copy for later use, that's one deal. And if you want to pay $5 but you can make exactly one copy on your digital VCR, that's another deal.
Well, I mean, as I said before, I don't have a problem with, I guess, the application of pay-per-view, but I think I could record something for pay-per-view, couldn't I?
I don't know. You're worried now, aren't you? That's the devil in the beginning. I don't want to try it out.
I don't want to give up the sort of...
But you don't have a digital VCR yet. You go to pay-per-view, you put it on your crappy, you know, four-head Sony special from Circuit City, it's just not going to be the same if you watch it again.
Right, the problem is that as far as the industry plans it, they're planning to move direct to HDTV as the standard. I mean, that's fine for now. I can say, well, I'm just not going to buy the HDTV, I'm not going to stick with my analog stuff and be able to take what I want and watch it when I want, just like I always have been able to. But then what happens when the industry gets to the point where they're ready to switch over to HDTV completely, and I'm not going to have, you know, analog television available to me.
Yeah, how about that? Listen, you were talking about, you rolled over pretty quickly on this verdict thing. And said, yeah, well, I guess you're sort of right that it's not that big a deal that I can't show the verdict with eight speakers in my classroom. I can just do it on VHS. But what happens when the verdict isn't available on VHS anymore? Then you can't record it. And you've got to pay the, I don't know, a fee of $5 times the number of people in your class just to project it to Austin West.
Exactly.
All right then.
Well, number one, you can hit a video camera. I'm sorry. You can hit a video camera and camcord it off the screen. We're perfectly willing to let him do that.
You are?
Absolutely.
Well, brand in there.
That's fair use.
Leaving it as an employer, I mean, at the time, you catch him doing it. You're going to take his excuse that he was just doing it for class.
We told the court that it's fair use, absolutely.
His intention.
Trusting us, it's fair use.
You'll trust him, particularly.
I mean, the question I think for the cable subscriber is, look, if you have a choice between this $9,000 gizmo without this protection mechanism, but an assurance that the motion picture companies will not have good movies broadcast, so that you'll be able to use the gizmo to watch Roseanne. Or they say, look, we will start broadcasting digital movies, but only if you agree to this gizmo. You've got a choice. Or if you're a congressman, you've got a choice. What choice do you make?
Correct. The cable subscriber would never get that choice.
Well, the representatives do. They passed the DMCA. They said, we think it's better to induce the distribution of DVDs, even if we have to limit the making of perfect digital clips. I mean, that's the trade-off. You talk about the balance of copyright with the show. Well, that was the balance they struck. And you are going to have the same choice, it seems to me. The motion picture company, Hollywood, is simply going to say, you want the gizmo, we'll give you the broadcast movies. You don't want the gizmo, fine, we're withholding our product. What do you want to do?
Well, we're actually at time. Eric Saltzman, Vertical Center, saying, Greg, you wanted to get the last word in. As a former litigious movie rights person, I figure you have a special
It's not the last word, it's a word. In this new discussion we're having, I want to remind everybody that what we're talking about is money, and that the government has always been happy to divide up pots of money. The last time, or the time this happened some years ago, was when cable was relatively new. Broadcast stations were broadcasting, cable operators were picking them up, and delivering that content outside of the broadcast area of the local station. And Congress decided that it was time to empower cable operators to lay wires, and they wanted the country wired. And so they set up a compulsory copyright license so that whether or not you wanted your local station's fare set out elsewhere, or if you were Warner Brothers and you made a TV show and it played only in Chicago, and you made a license in Chicago, all of a sudden that license picked up and sent out all over the country on cable. The arrangement that was made was that a small amount of money was paid by the cable systems to the compulsory copyright license, and that money, they had a royalty scheme, and the stations where the content owners applied for the money, and the money was sold out. So similarly, this is a similar thing. It's a pot of money to be fought over here.
I think the Cable Act of 92 took that trough and rearranged it.
In 92, right, but earlier,
right,
in the 80s,
right,
that's how it works.
In 92, we got the dual-pronged must-carry rule, right, said if there's a local station, and you have a cable outfit, a local broadcast station, you have a cable outfit in that area, that local station can demand that you carry them, even if it turns out it's some religious station up in the high 60s on UHF and nobody really wants to watch it, you must carry it. In order to preserve the diversity of local broadcasting. Prong two was, if it's Channel 7 and you really want to carry it on your cable, because if you don't have the basic NBC, ABC, CBS stations on your cable, nobody wants it, they can deny permission for you to carry it until you agree to whatever terms they want to impose. But I mean, I guess you're going to get your strategy at three.
Yes, I'm just talking about these things are arranged, they're fought over, and consumers come out with it, and with it, not depending on how much pressure they can put, or votes, or money they can deliver to the campaigns.
Gotcha. So this wraps up the third to last session of our class. Next Monday will be the penultimate session, in which Don DeWada joins us to talk to the similar bookend that this was to Napster. Don visits will be the protection of children and overall stuff on content control, and then we have the grand wrap up on Tuesday. So we'll get the reception on Monday night. Yes, Becca?
All of the readings for next Monday are available for you online, and there's a rotisserie question that's happening as our usual rotisserie questions happen, which is due on Sunday night in the crank that is for Tuesday.
It's a rotisserie question, I think, about COPA, about protecting kids, and then there's an optional question as well, which is giving you an opportunity to say what pieces you feel are missing, which will help me prepare the final session to wrap things up. Please join me in thanking our guests.